For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website. Good evening. I'm Aishin, Nancy Easton. And I wanted to talk tonight. I'm going to do a little show and tell, okay? My talk tonight is going to be on the recent trip to Tassajara that I made with a few other people from the Sangha, none of whom are here tonight. And this talk is mostly for Brian, who could not be there. But I brought back pictures. So while I'm talking, I thought I would pass around some highlights.
She said that because I was supposed to go and then I couldn't at the last minute.
Yeah. So this will bring you a little bit of the experience. And I think I'll just share a little bit about, the experience and my personal reflections. And I don't know what kind of discussion that might generate, but we'll see where it goes. Our Sangha's trip to Tassajara was, and when I say Tassajara, I mean Zen Shinji Tassajara Monastery, which is out in Carmel somewhere, out in the middle of really nowhere. It's in a very, very remote location at a hot springs resort in the Central California mountains. But our trip was made possible through Branching Streams, which is the organization of sanghas and teachers that sort of originate from the San Francisco Zen Center, and this is one of the original properties of San Francisco Zen Center. And it's really a combination Zen monastery and hot springs resort. So if you can imagine those two things coexisting, and I think it works very nicely because, like any place, they have to find a way to support themselves. And so they hold practice periods, two practice periods a year, from typically October through April. And then from May to September, they are really a hot springs resort with guest rooms and, sort of hot springs and pools and hiking and a lot of peace and quiet for people. So the location itself, we learned, has been a resort for about 150 years formally, and I imagine that it was, land that was found, the springs were found and were probably visited by a lot of Native American cultures for long, long before that. But I don't know a ton about the history. I know that it was purchased by San Francisco Zen Center in 1967. And so this was the second location that Zen Center occupied. And it was a place that Suzuki Roshi, our founder, really loved and really wanted to be at. And so it was a place that was very dear to his heart. And you can kind of tell that when you're there, as maybe you'll be able to see from some of the photos. There is, in particular, a building that you'll see a couple photos of, not the Zendo, but it's the Kaisando, which is the Founders Hall. And we had our study period every day for a couple hours in the Kaisando. And you can go there, and there's an altar, and there's a picture of Suzuki Roshi, and it's very much set up as a tatami room, and you can go and offer incense, and you can sit, or I think they use it for a lot of different things. So we were there quite a lot, but anyway. It's a very remote location, as I said earlier. It's located at the end of a 14-mile dirt road through the mountains, and, you know, kind of very steep up, very steep down. I think the first picture in the set is of where we all parked our vehicle so that we could get picked up by the stage, which was, I don't know, it was maybe a Chevy Bronco or something along that line, something that was able to, you know, drive in first gear for long periods of time, because it's really roads that are not, you know, there's no guardrail, and it's very steep. You're kind of right along the edge of the road, and you need to be able to, you know, drive in low gear. I think they recommend driving it at about 15 miles an hour, and I think the person who was driving us sometimes drove it at 15 miles an hour, but I think was so experienced with driving this that she could really, you know, kind of lay on the gas, which had me just sort of basically closing my eyes and chanting Dharanis continuously as a way of, like, trying to keep calm in this. And I chanted a lot of Dharanis because it takes about an hour. Actually, it's supposed to take about an hour. It took us about 45 minutes. So if that gives you any vindication of how fast we were going. But it was beautiful. And we did get out periodically to, you know, kind of look at the view. And you could see the ocean. And at one point, you know, I'm chanting my Dharani. And she's sort of narrating the drive. And she says, you know, so over there is where the car went off the edge. And I'm like, okay, all right, you know. You know, I'm in the middle of the Tahitian Dharani, and I'm going, okay, Fuji Sato Boya, Moko Sato Boya, and I'm thinking, like, I'm sure that was a long time ago. And of course somebody said, you know, oh, when was that? And she said, oh, May, and I'm like, okay, Ojayachi, Moko Ojayachi. I'm going, okay. It turned out there were a couple 20-year-olds who just kind of drove over the edge, and they were stopped by a boulder and by the bicycle rack on the back of their vehicle, and they were able to get out and walk to safety. So it's sort of a pilgrimage to get there. And when you get there, we were very much aware at the same time of the forest fires that are happening in Yosemite. When we were going in, you know, you could see it a little bit, but coming out, you could really see the smoke starting to move through the valley, and you could actually see it when we were there. It was getting increasingly just cloudy and smoky, and that was bringing up a lot of memories for different people, upsetting memories of times when they've experienced fire, and even recent times when they've had to protect Tassajara from fire. So when you get there, you're going to have, you know, a lot of peace and quiet. There's no cell phone service. There's no internet. You can make emergency calls. I had to give people a landline in case there was a family emergency. But, you know, you can get emergency calls in, and you can make emergency calls out. And so you're really there with yourself. And that was one of the first things that struck me was how quickly I turn to my cell phone during any kind of time of transition. And I really noticed it, and I started to regret all the times that I do this without thinking about it, you know, and it really made me think about, you know, the importance of taking time away from doing all the things that we do to sort of ease over or you know, help ourselves through the transitions in our day. It's hard sometimes to go from an activity to, you know, not being sure what happens next. And, you know, we can turn to all kinds of, I think, you know, so that we can use our cell phones as an addiction, or we can use TV or food, or, you know, lots of things that help us sort of just avoid those moments of uncertainty and those pauses. But those were very much at the forefront of my awareness during this time. So I want to talk a little bit about maybe the schedule. And the schedule in the summer is pretty loose compared to, I think, what it is typically like during a practice period and what I've experienced when I've been at Green Gulch for, like, the January intensive. There are really two basic periods of Zazen, one in the morning that lasts about an hour, although there's sort of a five-minute bell in the middle where you can move or adjust your posture. And then there's another, I think, 35-minute Zazen period in the evening. And in between that, there is a lot of work. The resort is being run by students and residents who are there practicing and working together, and maybe they're partly there, you know, working for a period of time so that they can do a practice period later on and not have to be working during it. But we were basically students by day and guests by night, so we got to experience both. During, you know, in the morning we would get up and do Zazen with the students and residents, and then we would have breakfast together, and then there's, you know, kind of a work meeting, and then there's about a 3.5 hour work period, during which time you're working pretty hard. The first day I was cleaning cabins and making beds and sweeping and got a little blister on my thumb from all this hard work. Other people were working in the garden, weeding and probably not planting, but weeding and watering. And other people, which is what I did my other couple days, were working in the kitchen, you know, chopping vegetables and, you know, helping in that way. And so after about 3.5 hours, there's a break for lunch. And then residents are working for another 3.5 hours. So they're working like, you know, the kind of 8 hour day that we all do. And then, you know, some people are also still working in the dining room later on, serving the guests, because the guests will be eating dinner later. Our afternoons were devoted to, we had a couple hours for studying, and then we had a couple hours of personal time. And there are services during the day. There's one right before lunch, and there's one right before dinner. And we could go to those if we had time. I never, until the very last day, I wasn't able to go to the noon service because we were always kind of working right up until the end. But I would try to get to the one right before dinner. And we kind of were on our own schedule in a way, which we adhered to, and that kind of helped give us a little bit of rhythm to the day. But it still felt a little bit like we had a lot of free time, more free time than I was used to, and so what we did during our free time were things like we would go for hikes together. We went down to, kind of hiked down the creek to what they call the Narrows, which I never made it to because at one point it just got so steep that I couldn't do it. But Matt did, and Bo did, and they will have pictures of that, and then I'll get to see what that was like. We also hiked up to, up the mountain. There is a memorial area for Suzuki Roshi. There's a stone that I believe some of his ashes are buried put underneath. And so we each got to go, and there's a small bucket of water, and you can go and make a little, you know, offering and scoop, ladle a bucket, pour a ladle of water over the stone, kind of like we do when we are bathing the baby Buddha for Buddha's birthday. And, you know, that's a way to remember Suzuki Roshi. And there's also another stone for Katagiri Roshi, and I believe there's one for Kobun Chino. And so that's, you know, you kind of hike up a hill, and I think you'll see a picture of a very simple gate with a number of us under the gate. It's sort of just a simple bow gate, and that's kind of the entryway to that area. And then you'll see me in the pictures kind of pouring water on a stone, and that's where we are and what I'm doing. And from there, you can really continue to hike way up into the mountains where you can really get a vista of the whole area. which we did. So I think we then had a little bit of time for study. I think some days some of us would go to the pool. There's a pool, which has been around for about 100 years and which is fed by the stream and by the hot springs. So they have water continuously flowing through there. And I don't think it's chlorinated because it's continuously flowing, but it's very nice. There's also basically the way that you bathe yourself there is in the hot springs. They've got sort of a building over by where the springs are, and they've kind of divided it up so that there are some on the men's side and some on the women's side. And there's a building, and so in the building it's sort of divided up, but there are showers and there's a steam room and a sauna and different kinds of one super hot indoor hot pool, and then another one that's outdoors that's a little cooler, and then you can sort of walk down to the stream and basically take a bath. And so that was our, and it is dusty there. It is really dusty. I really had to kind of wash everything when I got back. It is the dusty realms. I guess it doesn't rain in the summer at all. The rain that comes down, that whatever rain they get is really in the winter months. And so there's a whole creek bed that kind of runs through the middle of the, kind of along the Zendo and by some of the cabins. And it is completely dry. It's very strange to see and there are stones that, some of which were placed there by Suzuki Roshi that to kind of reinforce the creek, but it's just completely dry. So bathing is a good thing there. I guess in terms of study, one person had been there. Nicholas had been there before as a guest, and none of the rest of us had ever been. So we really wanted to just kind of look around and sort of take in the atmosphere and experience it. And we didn't have such a firm agenda. Our study consisted of one day sharing our stories of how we came to practice. And then people wanted to hear sort of the story of how Ancient Dragon came into being. So I talked about that a little bit. And then another day, we all read poems that Bo had found on gratitude and discussed some of these poems in terms of practice and Dharma. And then the third day, I really wanted us to read a chapter from Suzuki Roshi's book. It's a book that was compiled after he passed away, of his talks on the Sandokai, which is we call the harmony of difference and sameness. And the title of the book is Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness. So we have a copy in the library if you're interested in reading this. It's really a wonderful book, and I felt like it was especially apt because the book consists of 12 talks that he gave on the different verses from the Sandokai. And he gave them between, I think, May and July of 1970 at Tassajara. And I believe this may have been the last time he was able to be there before he passed away. And he talks about how, throughout the chapter that we read, he talks about how, much he loves being at Tassajara and how important this is to him to have a place to get away and be in nature. And so there's something about the practice of just practicing in nature that is, very much rooted in our tradition. Thank you. There are things I've noticed this on camping trips, by myself as well as during camping session. There are really things that you can experience very differently when you're just kind of out in nature and maybe out away from some of the technology. I should say something about the technology. It's not, I think it's no longer completely electricity free. I think early on there were kerosene lamps that were used to light everything, and now there is electricity for like electric lights, and I think there may be some electricity in the kitchen for some of the kitchen implements, but there's largely not electricity. I did have an overhead light in my cabin, but there's nowhere to plug things in. So you're really kind of out in nature. We wake up before dawn. Someone goes around with a wake up bell to all of the different cabins. Oh, I should say something about the accommodations. They are shared cabins, and you probably saw some of them in the pictures, including the one that Laurel and I shared with the two twin futons on the tatami floor. They're typically a double occupancy cabins. And so early in the morning, around 5:25 or 5:30, someone goes around with a wake-up bell to all of the cabins and down by the student housing, and just, you know, wakes everybody up. And then we get up, and you have to be in the zendo by 5:40 to start zazen at 5:50. And then, you know, sitting for an hour every day, you really just, you know, you kind of watch the world wake up. And I remember the first day that we were there when I, you know, got up and sat in the zendo, and I'm kind of watching, you know, you kind of just sort of watch the light come up. You can sort of see that you're suddenly able to see things that you weren't when you walked in. And I sat there and I thought to myself, you know, it would be so weird to be one of the guests here who are, you know, their breakfast for them is like 8:30 or something, and they're, you know, by and large sleeping in, although they could join zazen if they wanted to. But I found myself thinking, you know, you miss out so much. You know, there's no place I would rather be than just sitting here, you know, kind of watching the world wake up. And then at night you get to sit there and kind of watch the world, you know, kind of shut down and listen to, you know, animals calling each other and just, you know, listen to sort of the sounds of nature. So my personal impression, I think, was really, you know, one of a lot of stillness, but still a lot of freedom. You know, this schedule felt like there was a lot of freedom for us in it. I think I might have felt differently if I was working for another 3.5 hours in the afternoon and then doing other things. But it really was a very nice opportunity to go and practice, and, you know, practice as part of our sangha. One of the other things that I really, really appreciated was being there with friends. I think, you know, other times when I've gone to, you know, like the January intensive at Green Gulch, I've gone by myself, and you go and you make friends because everybody's there, you know, kind of by themselves. But it's very different having, you know, already sort of five people that, you know, can sort of just chuckle about some of the, you know, just the random things that happen. You know, like hearing about the car that went off the edge while we're sort of driving up through the mountains. And, you know, we can all laugh about that later. And there's a sense of having a sort of a shared experience that I appreciate. So it's possible that we might get to do this again one day. And if we do, I highly recommend doing it. It might not be fair for those of us who have done it once to do it again, but if there's an empty spot, I might do it again anyway. And I guess, what else do I want to say about that? There were lots of opportunities to talk with other people there. Our friend and former Branching Streams priest Hakusho was there. He and Marie both got there on the same day that we all did. So they were kind of moving their stuff in, and so we got to spend a fair amount of time talking with Hakusho and some of the other people living there. So, you know, we could talk a little bit as we were working. as well, and we got to meet some of the other students. This is another thing that you might do sometime if you want to. You can go there for a week and arrange to be a guest student. And there were lots of people who were there for a week or maybe a little bit more. My roommate from the January intensive this time was in the middle of doing a month there, and neither of us had known that we were both going, and so you know we kind of saw each other and went, whoa. And she's from Brooklyn, but she had applied and gotten to do a month-long period, and as is Michael Soder, who is there now doing a three-month period guest studentship, and he will be doing a practice period there in the fall. So it's a wonderful opportunity to go in whatever capacity you can go and practice with them for a little while and, you know, see what you bring back. I think that's maybe all I have to say.
And thank you very much, Adrian. Time is there.
Yeah.
Having lived there.
Lived there.
For about 3 years, quite a long time ago, in the early 80s, and then I've been practicing fairly since. Just one thing, well, it's just an amazing special place, as Asian mentioned. It had been a place where Native peoples went to do ceremonies because of the hot springs before white folks showed up. At some point, there was a big resort there for a long time. Around the 1900s, actually, it was the Chinese railroad workers who built the road in that makes it more navigable, although as Asian said, it's an interesting road. The other thing just to say is about the schedule that, aside from the Zazen and the Dharma teaching during the practice periods, and Dharma teaching sometimes during the summer as well, there's the quality of just this amazing place. It's just very remote, about 15 miles in from Base Air, in the Mahayana Mountains. But also the schedule is part of the teaching. This is something that's common to all the master experience across all different religious traditions. Just following a schedule, and for the group that went from expansion students guest, they had a looser schedule in the afternoon. But even during the practice period, there's a very full schedule of meditation and some work. When I first went there, there are little breaks in the schedule, not very long, but you learn to appreciate them. But I felt like it was more my time than I had ever experienced. Even though it was very fully scheduled, I didn't have to think about what I was going to do next. It just felt ready to go to the next thing. So the schedule itself is part of the teaching. Anyway, I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, thank you.
Any comments or questions for Asian about her experience or responses?
Oh, no.
Thank you for sharing that. It's very interesting. Do the people there keep normal silence? Or is there talking? Is it involved? It's not a retreat.
Well, you know, we were encouraged and sometimes admonished during work period to maintain what they call functional speech, which is you know just talking about what needs to be talked about as part of doing what you're doing, but they were very loose about really enforcing that. A lot of times it was really the guest students who would start talking a little bit, and There were conversations, so you're not really supposed to. But for the most part, although there were occasions where you know people would remind everybody to use functional speech, it just felt like it was a little bit more loose in terms of the discipline, imposed discipline.
During the 2 to 3 month practice period, it's different. There is silence from the beginning of evening zazen, through the night, through morning zazen, till what period of the next morning after study. So there's definitely some.
Yeah. You know, I just realized two things that I wanted to add. One is that they are really good, and this was a great lesson for me, in the ways that they very easily fold additional people into their schedule and to what they're doing. They every day, you know, you have some sense of what you're supposed to be doing, but they make it very easy. You know, there's a work period and everybody gets assigned something, and the people who are not assigned to anything go over and they get an assignment based on, you know, kind of what needs to be done that day. And then when you go to your area where you're working, somebody gives you a very brief orientation. They'll do a group orientation. The kitchen, it was, you know, talking about sort of how to safely handle knives, remember to put a headscarf on, remember to, you know, wear your apron, other things, you know, washing your hands. It's just very routinized, and everybody gets a task. And when you're done with your task, they have people in charge who can give you another task. And so, you know, they fold people in, nicely. And I imagine that's true for, you know, ways that people move into tasks with more responsibility. And it was really, you know, we could take a lesson from them. The other thing I wanted to say was, for each of our work periods, we were, you know, you bow in, kind of like we do with our work period. And then we chanted something together. When I was working on the cabins, we chanted the Guidepost of Silent Illumination from Hongzhe together. And after you chant it, there's an opportunity for everyone to share, you know, what piece of this touched you today. And so you're really paying attention and orienting yourself to the text. In the kitchen, we all chanted, they broke out the Tenzo Kyokun, or Dogen's instruction to the cook, into different, you know, kind of like chapters. And we would chant one chapter per day, and then same thing. There's some opportunity for commentary and people to, you know, kind of talk about what really struck them today. And this was wonderful too. I don't know that this would work for us in our work period or during Sesshin, because we typically have, you know, much more limited time because we're in a Sesshin. But that was another nice way that they had of, you know, helping us to feel a little oriented and a little part of something, and made work be, it reminded us that work is about practice and not just about work, which I think, you know, the verse that you've created, Brian, does that really well in a much more succinct way, and it really works based on the time that we have. But I also like the opportunity to, you know, chant something longer together. So there were lots of reminders of practice, even within, you know, something that felt more relaxed.
You mentioned the lack of cell phone use as sort of a lesson in that for your daily life. And I'm wondering if there's anything else besides that that you feel you're bringing back with you in terms of practice or insight or anything into the daily life that you live here, your normal everyday life.
That's a really good question. I hadn't thought about that. I've been extremely busy since I got back. But I've noticed that I know what all the things are, and I know that they're, you know, I know when they're going to need to be taken care of, but I can focus really on just one at a time. For the most part. So, you know, I knew I had to do this talk tonight, so I, you know, put a little time into it, and then I really didn't think about it until I got here, except for choosing photos. So, you know, it's like I can be very focused and just focus on the task at hand. So this experience was a good reminder in that. I didn't really sleep when I was there for some reason. I just couldn't sleep more than like 4 hours. So what I did when I got back was just, I've just been sleeping. If there was some, I wasn't tired, I just was, you know, kind of just awake in a way. Ed.
What is the air like?
The air? It's funny that you should ask that. The air was so dry. I couldn't breathe very well. Yeah. Yeah, my sinuses were dried out.
Say compared to the air here.
Yeah. Yeah, it was drier. That may have had something to do with the forest fires. Pardon?
Probably.
Yeah, because it was just painful, actually.
Oh, painful?
Yeah. Yeah. There was fog as we got back north into San Francisco, but not there. No. It's yeah, a little bit more desert-like.
I saw the photographs. There's live oak trees, quite a few.
Yeah. We were mostly trying to avoid the poison oak, but we did see oak trees. We had a lot of time to hike around, actually, because there are a lot of moving pieces to getting six people there. So we ended up some people got there at a different time due to flight situations, and so there were lots of time to hike through other areas in California. The first day was down near Monterey at Point Lobos, and then the second day was, I forget, there was a nature preserve out in Carmel that we hiked around, and so we saw a lot of laurel trees. There was, it's laurel everything, but we also saw some oak trees.
Sometimes with that drier air, the shadow lines are very sharp, and the light's very bright.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Yeah, it could be very, very stark. The photos, like always, just don't capture it. I kept looking at everything, and then you look through your lens and it's just like, well, yeah, it's kind of like what it was. I mean, yeah, there's a cabin and a tree, but it just doesn't capture it. I think that's why I included the picture of the Rakasu and Ocasa shelves, because it's just, there are just all these little, moments of random beauty that you come across that unfortunately don't look like much of anything when you're in a photo, but there is something about the quality of the light and... I don't know. You're in a valley. By the time you get down to... the monastery, you're actually in a valley. So it may not be that high at all. Yeah. Yeah, you have to go up over some mountains and then down. So you're down by the streams. Yeah.
What was the biggest lesson that non-intense schedule taught you?
I kind of missed the intensity. But in another way, I was really struck by the lack of the melancholy feeling that I feel at an intensive where you never have quite enough time for anything. You can relax for a little while, but you're going to have to stop relaxing before you're ready to stop. And that feeling was not there, and I really noticed its absence in a way. But then what's lost, so you gain that, but then what's lost by that is a feeling of the discipline and the support that a tighter schedule gives you. So it's neither good nor bad. He's doing well. He's doing well. We saw him quite a lot, and he really seems to be settled into being there. And I think he's really appreciating being there.
Well, thank you very much.
I think Nicole had a question.
Do you feel the point of your meditation there is better
No, I didn't. It was weird. I just was never really tired. Maybe that was something to do with the air. The meditation feels different because even when we're indoors, there's a lot of nature that permeates. Everything is screened in so that, you know, there are those sort of little paper windows that you can push together, and then just, you know, sounds and light and air is coming in from the outside. So it seemed different that way. Yeah, I just didn't want to miss anything, so I think I just was, you know, awake. But anyway, thank you for listening to my travelogue.
Thank you for going, and thank you for coming back. And we'll close with the four bodhisattva vows.